Normally, we think of computer programming as this kind of, well, like an absolute dictatorship.
Right, yeah.
Like you write a strict set of rules, you hand it to the computer, and the machine just follows them, blindly to the letter.
Exactly.
If you tell it to crash, it crashes. But today's deep dive is pulling from a stack of research papers on a completely different universe of computing. We're looking at genetic operators in machine learning.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff.
It really is. We are looking at how computers use the literal, like, messy concepts of biological evolution
Yeah.
to actually solve problems. So, okay, let's unpack this. If standard programming is like giving a machine a highly specific recipe to bake a cake, right?
Right.
Like crack exactly 2 eggs, whisk for exactly 3 minutes, bake at 350 degrees.
A very rigid process.
Exactly. A genetic algorithm is more like tossing that computer into a kitchen with just flour, sugar, and heat, and letting it evolve the perfect cake over, thousands of generations of just trial and error.
Yeah. What's fascinating here is that we are literally borrowing the mechanisms of biological survival and we're applying them to cold, hard data.
Right.
It represents a total paradigm shift. I mean, the machine is no longer following a static path that was carved out by a human programmer.
It doing its own thing.
Exactly. It is reading potential solutions, mutating their data, and then forcing them to compete in the simulated environment.
Wow.
So we move away from human-dictated rules and step fully into, well, evolutionary discovery.
Which is just wild to think about. So the mission today is to demystify how that actually works. We need to understand how algorithms can, mimic reproduction and mutation.
Right.
And more importantly, I think, why an AI researcher would choose to use this instead of just traditional coding.
Yeah, why go through all the trouble?
Right. But before we get to the actual machine learning applications, let's kind of look at the biological blueprint. The source material refers to the engines of this process as genetic operators, and the whole thing starts with a blank slate. Well, essentially total chaos.
It's very chaotic.
You have a problem, and the algorithm just throws out a massive population of completely random candidate solutions. Just totally random guesses.
Right. And once you have that initial pool of random guesses, the immediate problem is figuring out, well, which ones are completely useless and which ones show a tiny bit of promise.
Yeah.
That requires a pretty brutal grading system. In the algorithm, this is called fitness evaluation.
Okay, fitness evaluation.
Right. Every single random guess is tested against the problem and given a mathematical fitness score.
So we have this pool of candidates, and they've all been graded.
Yes.
The algorithm now has to decide, who gets to survive and reproduce. And the sources outline a few ways this selection happens.
They do.
There is rank-based selection, where the algorithm literally lines them up from best to worst, which makes sense.
Very straightforward.
Yeah. Then there is tournament selection, where it grabs a random handful of solutions, throws them in a ring, and only the highest scorer of that specific group survives.
Right, like a little micro competition.
Exactly. And then there is the roulette wheel approach, which assigns a probability of survival based on the fitness score.
But I have to push back on this roulette concept a bit.
Okay, sure.
Because if we are running complex data sets, why are we spinning a wheel?
You're wondering why introduce chance?
Yeah. Isn't that just gambling? I mean, why wouldn't the algorithm just select the absolute top 1% of candidates every single time to breed the next generation? Why leave it to a wheel?
It's a great question. But if you only ever select the literal best of the best, your population loses genetic diversity almost immediately.
Oh, I see.
Think about it mathematically, right? If only the top 1% reproduce within maybe 3 generations, every single offspring is going to have the exact same data structure.
Because they're all coming from the exact same parents. Exactly. The algorithm will completely stall out.
Yeah.
By using a roulette wheel approach, the highest scoring solutions get the largest slices of the wheel, meaning they are highly likely to be selected.
Okay.
But the mediocre solutions, the ones that scored poorly overall, they still get a tiny sliver of the wheel.
So the algorithm intentionally keeps some of the losers around.
It has to. I mean, a candidate solution that is generally weak might harbor one specific highly valuable snippet of code or data.
Oh, wow. Oh.
Right. If you let that mediocre candidate reproduce, that single valuable trait might eventually combine with a strong solution a few generations down the line to create the ultimate answer.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, probability heavily favors the strong, but you maintain the variety that's absolutely necessary for true evolution to happen.
Which brings us to the actual reproduction phase. The sources call this crossover.
Yes, crossover. crossover.
This is where the algorithm takes two of those selected parent solutions and combines their data to create offspring. But I'm trying to picture how that actually works in code.
It can be a little abstract.
Yeah, because if a solution is just a long string of data, say a list of 50 numbers or a binary string of ones and zeros,
right?
How does the machine physically combine them without just corrupting the whole thing?
Well, the algorithm treats that data string like a biological chromosome.
Okay.
The simplest method is a single point crossover. So the algorithm picks one spot right in the middle of the data string, cuts both parents in half at that exact same location, and basically swaps the tails.
Hmm.
So the offspring gets the first half of parent A and the second half of parent B.
But wait, what if the really important traits in parent A are at the very beginning and the very end of the string? Because a single cut in the middle is going to separate them every time, right?
That is exactly where the operator needs to be adjusted based on the specific problem you're trying to solve.
Oh, so they change the method.
Right. If traits are spread out, you might use what's called a multi-point crossover.
Yep.
That's cutting the data in four or five places and weaving it together.
Okay, like shuffling a deck.
Kind of, yeah. Or in some really complex spaces, you use a uniform crossover.
How does that one work?
In that scenario, the algorithm goes down the data string item by item, and for every single variable, it basically flips a coin to decide whether the offspring inherits parent A's value or parent B's value.
Wow. Every single data point gets a coin flip.
Exactly. It allows the algorithm to discover entirely new combinations of granular data that might perform radically better than either parent ever did.
But, you know, even with all that mixing and matching, you are still only shuffling the traits that already exist in the population, right?
That's true.
Like, if the specific piece of data you need to solve the problem wasn't in that initial pool of random guesses, crossover's never going to find it. You'll just keep shuffling the same exact deck of cards.
Which is why the mutation operator is the ultimate insurance policy here.
Mutation.
Yes. Mutation introduces entirely new genetic material by forcing small random changes into the offspring as data string.
Okay, and the sources explain this beautifully, I think, with this concept of escaping a local optimum.
Yes, that's a crucial concept.
So if we visualize an algorithm trying to find the best solution, imagine it as a blindfolded person trying to climb to the highest peak in a mountain range.
I love this analogy.
Yeah, so traditional optimization just tells the person to keep stepping upward, right? As long as the next step is higher, just take it.
That's the law.
Right. The problem is they might walk up a small hill, reach the top, and realize every step in any direction is downhill.
Right.
But because they are blindfolded, they think they've conquered Mount Everest. That small hill is what they call a local optimum. It looks like the best answer based on the immediate surroundings, but it's actually a trap.
Exactly. And without mutation, an algorithm just converges on that small hill.
It gets stuck.
It does. It sees that every other immediate option is worse, and it just stops evolving entirely. Mutation is the mechanism that randomly picks that blindfolded climber up and basically throws them across the valley. Yeah, it forces the algorithm to explore the wider landscape.
And mechanically, I mean, in the code, how is it throwing them across the valley?
Well, it depends on how the data is structured. If the solution is a binary string, the mutation operator might perform a simple bit flip.
A bit flip?
Yeah, it randomly targets one single zero in a string of, say, thousands, and just flips it to a one.
That sounds so minor, though.
It sounds minor, but in a complex model, changing one fundamental parameter can completely alter the behavior of the solution.
Oh, I see.
And if the data is a sequence, the operator might use an inversion mutation. That means grabbing a whole chunk of the data array and completely reversing its order.
Oh, wow. So suddenly, the sequence of operations the AI is trying to perform is totally flipped on its head.
Exactly. Now, most of the time, these random mutations create a terrible solution that immediately dies out in the next fitness evaluation.
Right, because it's random. It usually breaks things.
Exactly. But occasionally, that random flip lands the climber on the slope of the real Mount Everest.
That is so cool. Okay, so we've mapped out the biology part. We understand the mechanics of selection, crossover, and mutation. Now we have to kind of crock the bridge into modern artificial intelligence.
Let's do it.
Because how does an engineer actually apply these genetic operators to train a real machine learning model? Because we aren't just evolving abstract math problems here.
No, we're not.
These algorithms are interacting with real data sets.
Right. And machine learning fundamentally involves just a massive amount of searching.
Searching for what?
You are constantly searching for the right variables, the right settings, or the right structures. Genetic operators really shine in massive, irregular search spaces where the number of possible combinations is just so large that humans or even brute force computing couldn't possibly test them all.
Okay, and the text points to feature selection as the classic example of this.
Yes, that's a great one to start with.
Let's look at a predictive model for housing prices, for instance.
Sure.
If you want a machine learning model to predict what a house will sell for, you have to feed it features, right?
Data points, yeah.
Square footage, number of bathrooms, lot size. But a modern data set might have, I don't know, 100 features.
Easily.
Include the age of the roof, the distance to the nearest grocery store, the local crime rate, the soil type, the noise level from the street.
It's a lot of data, and you do not want to feed all 100 features into your model.
Really? Why not?
Because some of that data is redundant, and some of it is just pure noise. Feeding in useless data will actually confuse the model and destroy its accuracy.
Ah, I see.
So the problem is figuring out which specific combination of those 100 features creates the most accurate prediction.
And if an engineer tried to manually test every possible combination of 100 features, they'd be dealing with 2^100 combinations.
It's a huge number.
Yeah. I actually ran the math on this before we started. That number is larger than the number of atoms in the observable universe.
It really is.
You couldn't test them all if you ran the world's fastest supercomputer from the dawn of time until today.
Exactly. And this is where you deploy the genetic algorithm.
Okay, so how does it handle that?
Well, you don't try to test everything. You initialize a population of random feature subsets.
Oh, random groups of features.
Right. So candidate one might use square footage, roof age, and distance to a grocery store. Candidate two uses number of bathrooms, soil type, and noise level.
Okay.
You train quick miniature models on these subsets and you evaluate their fitness. Basically, how accurately do they predict the price?
Right.
Then you select the best subsets, you cross their features over, and randomly mutate them.
So maybe the mutation drops distance to grocery store and just randomly adds local crime rate.
Exactly. And over 50 or 100 generations, the algorithm naturally strips away the noise and evolves a highly optimized, precise subset of features.
It's basically automating the intuition of a data scientist.
Very much so.
And the sources show this goes way beyond just picking the data. It actually extends to what they call hyperparameter optimization.
Yes.
Because when you build an AI, there are all these underlying settings, right? Like the control knobs on the machine itself.
Right, the architecture settings, yeah.
You have the learning rate, which dictates how aggressively the model updates its beliefs. You have the depth of the decision trees. You have regularization parameters that stop the model from just memorizing the data instead of learning.
Right. And tuning these knobs manually is one of the most tedious parts of machine learning.
I can imagine.
Because the relationship between a learning rate and a tree depth is highly nonlinear. Changing one knob completely changes how the other knob behaves.
So it's not just a simple checklist.
Not at all. It creates a chaotic mathematical landscape. So a genetic algorithm treats these settings as genetic traits.
Okay, so how does that look?
You encode the learning rate, the tree depth, and the regularization penalty into a single data string. Then the algorithm breeds these control panels, mutating the dial slightly in every generation until it discovers the exact configuration that locks the model into peak performance.
That is amazing. But here is where the source material just completely blew my mind.
Oh, yeah.
It talks about neural architecture search.
Yes.
We were talking about using these genetic operators to evolve the literal structure of a neural network.
It's incredible.
Right. It isn't just turning the dials anymore. It is designing the brain itself.
And this is arguably the most profound application of genetic operators in AI today.
Oh, really?
Oh, absolutely. Historically, designing a deep neural network was almost an art form. A human engineer would look at a problem and rely on their intuition to decide how many layers of artificial neurons to stack together, how those layers should connect, and what mathematical activation functions should fire between them.
Right. The human is just guessing based on experience. Like, I think this image recognition model needs 50 layers of convolution.
Exactly. And humans are biased.
Oh, so?
Well, we like symmetry. We like clean, logical patterns.
Mm-hmm.
But the optimal brain for a specific task might be incredibly messy and asymmetrical.
Oh, interesting.
Neural architecture search shifts the burden of design entirely away from human intuition.
Okay.
The genetic algorithm generates a population of wildly different neural network architectures. Some are deep and narrow, some are shallow and wide, some have bizarre skipping connections between layers that a human would never dream of wiring together.
And then the algorithm trains all these mutant brains for a few epochs, right? It grades their performance and then literally breeds the architecture.
You've got it.
It takes a block of layers from a successful wide network, crosses it over with a block of layers from a successful deep network, and creates a child architecture.
Yes. And the result is often a network topology that looks completely alien to human eyes.
Oh, it works.
It outperforms anything a human engineer could design manually. It fundamentally changes the role of the AI researcher from a builder of brains to more of a designer of evolutionary environments.
That's so cool. The text also touches on ensemble optimization, which honestly feels like the logical conclusion of all this.
It really does.
You evolve a bunch of these highly specialized AI models, and then you use a genetic algorithm to figure out how to group them into a team.
Exactly.
Like if you have 20 different models predicting the stock market, the genetic algorithm breeds different combinations of those models, figuring out exactly how much weight to give to Model A's prediction versus Model B's prediction to get the strongest overall portfolio.
Yeah.
It's basically like managing a sports team and letting thousands of generations of evolution decide your starting lineup.
That's a perfect analogy. Mm-hmm. And it finds synergy between predictive models that human analysts would just entirely miss.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It might figure out that Model C is terrible at general predictions, but incredibly accurate during sudden market crashes.
Okay.
So it evolves an ensemble that heavily weights Model C only under specific data conditions.
That makes so much sense. But, okay, with all of these massive capabilities, you know, evolving features, hyperparameters, neural structures, entire ensembles,
right,
we have to confront the reality check presented in the research.
Yeah, we do.
Because if this evolutionary approach is so powerful, why isn't every single artificial intelligence system built this way? I mean, why hasn't evolutionary computing completely cannibalized traditional deep learning?
It comes down to one primary reason, and that is computational efficiency.
Efficiency, okay.
Traditional optimization methods like gradient descent are what power the vast majority of modern AI. And gradient descent operates on a clear mathematical landscape.
How does that compare to the genetic approach?
Well, if you are trying to optimize a model, gradient descent can calculate the exact slope of the curve and point you directly toward the bottom of the valley, which represents the lowest error rate. It is literally like having a perfect topographical map of the terrain.
And if you have a map, you don't need to drop 1,000 blindfolded clones all over the mountain and see who survives.
Exactly.
You just walk down the path.
Exactly. When the mathematical space is relatively smooth and predictable, traditional gradient-based methods will find the optimal solution exponentially faster than a genetic algorithm.
Because genetic operators require you to initialize, train, and evaluate entire populations of models over and over again.
Yes. The computational overhead is just massive. You are burning through server farms just to evaluate the 1,000 mutations in generation 50, and you might need 500 generations.
Wow. So genetic algorithms are really reserved for the landscapes where the map breaks down.
Yeah.
The spaces that are so chaotic, jagged, and nonlinear that gradient descent just gets hopelessly stuck in those local optima traps.
That is the dividing line. But even when you use a genetic algorithm in those complex spaces, you are managing a very fragile system.
Fragile.
The biggest pitfall researchers run into is premature convergence.
Which goes back to the mutation rates, right?
Yeah.
Like if you set the mutation rate too low, the population becomes identical too quickly.
Yes. If the selection pressure is too ruthless, if you heavily favor the winners and your mutation rate is basically zero, all the genetic diversity gets wiped out in the first 5 generations.
Wow. So everyone just looks the same.
Every single candidate starts looking like the one early winner. And once the population is genetically identical, crossover does nothing. You are literally just swapping identical pieces of code.
Right.
The algorithm settles on a subpar solution and just stops evolving entirely.
On the flip side, though, the text notes that if the mutation rate is too high, you destroy the progress.
Right.
Because you are just injecting chaos into every generation. None of the good traits ever survive long enough to build on each other.
It becomes pure randomness.
It feels like the person running this algorithm is acting less like a traditional coder typing syntax and more like a a zookeeper trying to manage the environmental pressures of a terrarium.
The zookeeper analogy holds up perfectly, especially when you look at the fitness function.
The grading system.
Right. In traditional programming, if you write a bad line of code, the software crashes and throws an error. You know it S broken.
Yeah.
In a genetic algorithm, if you write a flawed fitness function, the grading system, the program won't crash. It will run perfectly.
Wait, really?
Yes. But it will ruthlessly and efficiently evolve to solve the wrong problem.
Oh, wow.
It will optimize for exactly what you asked it to measure, exploiting any possible loophole in your grading system to maximize its score, even if the resulting behavior is completely useless in the real world.
That is terrifying and amazing, which really makes the real-world applications of this so fascinating, because researchers are getting the grading systems right.
They are.
The sources list a dozen different industries relying on this. In healthcare, they're using genetic algorithms to sift through massive genomic data sets, literally evolving models that predict patient disease trajectories.
Yes.
In logistics, they're using them to optimize supply chain routing, managing thousands of trucks and variables in real time. But the application that really cements how this works is in physical robotics.
Oh, absolutely. Robotics is a perfect environment for genetic operators because the physical world is incredibly messy and nonlinear.
Right. Imagine a team trying to design a walking motion for a new four-legged robot. A traditional engineer would try to manually code the exact angle of every servo and the timing of every joint. It takes months of tweaking just to get the robot to take one single step without falling over.
It's incredibly tedious.
But with a genetic algorithm, you build a physical simulation. You generate a starting population of 1,000 virtual robots, and you give them all completely randomized joint parameters.
And generation one is a total disaster.
Total disaster. You hit run on the simulation, and 999 of these robots immediately collapse, flail their legs, or just twitch violently on the floor.
It's a mess.
But the fitness function grades them on one simple metric.
Mm-hmm.
How far did your center of mass move forward before you fell?
Right.
And one of those twitching robots manages to randomly flop 2 inches forward. That is the winner of generation one.
And then the algorithm selects that flopping motion, crosses its parameters with another robot that maybe managed to drag itself an inch.
Yeah.
It introduces some random mutations to the joint angles and generates 1,000 new robots.
And it's crazy because by generation 50, you have a population of robots that are consistently crawling.
Yes.
By generation 200, the mutations have evolved a stumbling walk. And by generation 500, the algorithm has discovered a hyper-efficient, perfectly balanced stride.
It's amazing to watch.
And the wildest part is, the stride often looks completely alien.
Yeah.
It might be this weird, asymmetric, insectoid, scurrying motion that is perfectly optimized for the physics of that specific robot frame. Like a motion a human engineer would never think to design.
Exactly. It bypasses human bias and discovers the raw mathematical truth of the environment.
Wow.
The takeaway from the research isn't that genetic algorithms are replacing deep learning. They are serving as highly specialized partners.
Right.
When traditional AI hits a wall in a massive, jagged search space, the genetic operators step in to evolve a path forward.
It really fundamentally changes how we view problem solving in computer science. But it does leave us with a lingering issue that the source material points out very explicitly.
What's that?
Well, genetic algorithms, by their very nature, do not guarantee that they will find the global optimum.
Right, they don't.
They do not guarantee mathematical perfection.
Yeah.
They search until they find a solution that is simply good enough to survive the constraints you gave them.
They're satisficers.
Yeah. And as we increasingly hand over high-stakes, real-world systems to these evolutionary models, whether that is predicting a medical diagnosis or piloting a physical machine through a crowded city, we are relying on systems born from random mutations and an imperfect survival of the fittest.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you wonder, right? As these systems get more complex, are we truly comfortable trusting our lives to an AI that is fundamentally designed not to be perfect, but simply to be good enough to survive?
It really forces us to accept that as machines become more advanced, they're becoming less like simple calculators and a lot more like us.
Yeah. The cake is out of the oven, but we have absolutely no idea what the recipe was.
Right.
Well, thanks for taking the deep dive with us today.